And welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. This is Kevin Swanson. And for the last 10 years, friends, we've been doing the best that we can to revive the family in America and to get back to biblical principles as they apply to the family and to economics. That's one reason we're reviving the family economy. We've got our conferences, we've got our website, FamilyEconomics.com, and we've got some great concepts that we bring out on interviews all the time. The 20th century was a horrible century for the family. Could have been the worst century ever. Dr. James Dobson recently wrote that the most devastating thing that happened in the 20th century was the destruction of the family in the West. But the thing that our pro-family friends do not consider, friends, are the economic forces involved in the splitting up of the family. The economic aspect is important, and we have this tremendous force that has come against the family economically, pounding the nuclear family to death, tearing and tearing and tearing it apart. And unless we address the economic aspects of this, all of our pro-family radio programs will be of no real use. We need to address all of these various aspects of the family. We need to get back to basic biblical principles as they apply to all these other areas. And that's one reason why part of our ministry is really going after the fundamental solutions. And we are interested, friends, in the social disintegration that's happened through economies. We're not going to separate the economic aspect from the social aspect. The social disintegration, the economic disintegration come together. And the destruction of the family in the 21st century has a great deal to do with these economic forces, as well as moral forces, of course. And by the way, the Bible does speak to economics and presents a form of economics that is not capitalistic and not really socialistic. You have these two different humanistic approaches to economics, the capitalism approach and the socialism approach. Actually, the Bible involves family economies, family-based charity, churches taking care of widows, churches-based charitable systems, churches, church-based medical systems, et cetera, et cetera. The Bible presents a different economic system than the socialists, like the Marxists that have been imposing their systems upon us for a very long time. Well, in just a moment, we're going to talk with somebody who has done an amazing amount of historical work on the family economy. Alan Carlson has a book out called Third Ways, How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economies and Why They Disappeared. He's got a number of books out on the family economy, which, by the way, has been around for 5,900 years, until the experiment of the last 100 years, which is not going very well. We'll be back in just a moment with Alan Carlson, friends. Stay with us.
Every year, Generations with Vision sponsors a family economics conference somewhere in America. This year, we are sponsoring two conferences, one in Washington State and the other in St. Louis, Missouri. For families who want to reintegrate the family into a family economic vision, for families who want to find ways to mentor their sons and daughters into the family economy, this is just the conference for you. How do you choose the optimum business streams for your family? How do you integrate your children into the family economy? What about budgets and debt and capital investments? And what about inheritance and taking care of grandpa and grandma along the way? We'll have young entrepreneur panels, mom and daughter panels, farming panels, retail and e-commerce panels, audience surveys, and some great keynote speakers, including free-range farmer Joel Salatin, entrepreneur Eric Weir, and Kevin Swanson. Join us for our four-day mega conference in St. Louis or the two-day fall conference in Olympia, Washington. Register today at FamilyEconomics.com. That's FamilyEconomics.com.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson here with you as we try to grab onto a little faith, family, and freedom in the 21st century as these things slowly dissipate in the slow demise of the Western civilization. But friends, we're reconstructing some things, and one of the main things we bring to bear on this program is family economies, because we have got to find ways to reconstruct the family. Family is breaking down, no question about it. 50% of kids born out of wedlock to women 30 years and younger, half of marriages end in divorce, 64% of kids are latchkey. This to us is bad news. This is a bad trajectory for the family. But the economy is not doing as well either. So we're not going to survive with the debt-laden economic systems that have been incorporated in our corporate system or governmental systems, and this thing's just not going to continue on. You can't break down your social systems and break down your economic systems without having a broken socioeconomic system. So how do we address this? But by reconstructing the family and by reconstructing the economies, and one of the best solutions we've come up with is the family economy, which has been around for 5,900 years, off and on, most of the time, until the modern age where the corporate fascists and the socialists and the communists and all the rest have tried out their little experiments and, of course, found wanting. Well, friends, today we're going to talk about the history of the family economy. And there is an excellent new book out that I want to recommend to you. We just found it about a month ago. We're very excited about this book. It's been out actually for a couple of years. It's called Third Ways: How Bulgarian Greens, Swedish Housewives, and Beer-Swilling Englishmen Created Family-Centered Economies and Why They Disappeared. The author is Alan Carlson. He teaches at Hillsdale College, and he's also the International Secretary for the World Congress of Families. He's done extensive research on the history of family economies, and he's here to share with us today. Alan, welcome to the program.
Pleased to be with you.
Wow, we're so happy about finding this book, because I think some of us thought of ourselves as coming up with an idea in the middle of history. We have no idea what our context is and whether it's been tried before, except for the fact that, I guess, you know, the agrarian society was highly family oriented for many, many centuries. But it seems to have disappeared on us.
Well, I'm a historian, and history can be very humbling.
Yes.
When you think you're onto something new.
This is not new.
No, the normal course of human experience, again, since human beings appeared on this earth, has been to live and exist and work in families.
Yes, yes.
The vast, until just about 100, 150 years ago, the vast majority of human beings, 95, 98%, lived and worked in the same place.
Mm.
And that's the normal status of human affairs. That's how we're supposed to live.
Until the modernists showed up and fixed everything.
Well, that's right. it was part economic revolution. The Industrial Revolution was a real thing.
Yes.
And what we have to remember, though, is that the Industrial Revolution was also a friend of centralization.
Yes.
It was why governments in the 17th, well, 18th, and 19th centuries commonly favored the industrialization process. Why? Because it did weaken families and family systems. That was not just an accidental byproduct. It was partly the intent of the system. And we are living at this point in time in the wake of this Industrial Revolution that went along with the growth of statist revolution, and the two together have sharply reduced, although not eliminated, the family economy.
Mm. What happens to a society where 64% of kids under six are latchkey, half of marriages end in divorce, and half of kids are born out of wedlock? It just seems to me that's a recipe for disaster. What are sociologists saying about that?
Well, sociologists, social historians say the inevitable result of that is going to be a system where the state increasingly takes care of people. It takes care of the children. It takes care of the elderly. It declares marriage to be weak and fragile and operates in that way. It creates, by intent or by unintended effect in some cases, the socialist dream. There's nothing standing between the individual and the state.
Mm-hmm.
You are simply your security rests with the state, and the family. The family largely fades away and disappears as a meaningful entity.
But it seems to me that that's a bad experiment. It seems to me that's going to yield an unstable society any way you look at it.
Well, there's no way to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
What we're running into right
yeah,
now. That's why the welfare states of Western Europe and the United States are in deep crisis.
Yes, yes.
It is families, productive families, that produce wealth and that manage to be somewhat autonomous and self-reliant. Unmarried people, particularly the children of out-of-wedlock families, these are all they're slated, in fact, inevitably for dependency on their neighbors and on others. Unfortunately, there are those politicians, political figures, and ideological figures who think this is a good thing. But it does not work, not even on paper.
Hmm. Now, I mentioned our family economies to you off air and pointed out, you know, some examples, a family that has a honey business in California, and they're doing very, very well. And they're even, you know, purchasing a home for each of their children, paid off debt free for each of them as they go. And it's an extremely productive household. It just blows my mind how much they're accomplishing. That's not unusual for you. That didn't come as a surprise to you, did it?
Oh, no, not at all. In our own time, it's possible, very possible, that if enough people rally around the call to restore the family economy, that it can be done.
Okay. I mean,
we have the tools to do it now. It is true. Early on in the 18th century, 19th century, centralized factories had a great advantage. They had a monopoly on power sources, such as water power and steam power. Family economy couldn't compete. It's no longer true. I mean, there's the revolutions of even things like the internal combustion engine, the small electrical engine, the electrical grid. Early in the 20th century, those bring power sources to the home if you figure out creative ways to use it. Even the Amish, for example, have restored a wonderful family economy system using hydraulic power and have figured that out. In our time, more recently, in the last 20 or 30 years, while the Internet can be a source of horrible things like pornography and so on, it's also a remarkable tool allowing a family businesses to market on an equal basis with the giants out there.
You know, that's
they're clever and creative.
That's the basis of my family economy. Almost every one of my children are involved in this radio program in some way, shape, or form. And, of course, our product sales and all the rest on the Internet. And, you know, it's just booming. It's unbelievable what the Internet has done for us. And I tell people I compete with CBS, NBC, and ABC. They're losing market share to me in my basement and my little operation, which, by the way, is growing in leaps and bounds every year. It's amazing.
Well, I'll have to come and borrow some money from you.
Yeah.
That's true. And again, that's the miracle of the digital world. And again, there's a dark side to it, but what we need to emphasize far more are the enormous potentials that come with that. And again, particularly as print media are going into decline, the Internet is replacing them, and unless monopolists somehow grab a hold of the Internet and squeeze it and turn it to the advantage of the big guys again, as long as its independence and autonomy is protected, yeah, you're there on an equal basis with the biggest guys if you're good at it.
One of the lines we use in our movement is the technology that took dad out of the home could bring dad back into the home, and we're finding a lot of fathers are working out of the home now. Using the Internet and all the rest, and they actually do a lot of contracting as well. I think contractualization is one way in which we can pick off a piece of the macro economy and move it back under the rubric of the family economy.
Well, it's true for a whole lot of other things as well. For example, consider the professions. The professions were industrialized. By that, I mean law, medicine, and so on.
Yeah.
Dentist's office. They were industrialized. Large clinics became the thing. If you're going to be a doctor, you worked out of a hospital or a large medical clinic. Lawyers gathered in huge offices. Well, that doesn't have to be. There's absolutely no reason, particularly given, again, technological revolution, that a doctor, a family practice doctor, can't operate out of his or her own home. Why lawyers can't work. The main thing holding that back these days are restrictive zoning laws and restrictive covenants in suburban subdivisions, which don't allow you to do anything productive in your home. Those should be tossed out.
Yeah,
because there again, it's another whole area, another whole phase of work that can easily, in our age, be reintegrated back into homes and turn empty, sterile neighborhoods into busy, productive places.
And I see that happening here and there. Tends to happen more in the rural areas, I think, where people get a few acres and have a little space between their neighbors than it does in, say, downtown Denver.
Or in suburban Denver. But
yeah.
There again, the main problem in both, particularly in the suburbs, are these restrictive zoning laws and restrictive covenants. And that can be changed. And even the suburbs can be brought back to life as a meaningful, productive workspace. There's the technology is potentially, or in fact, in many practical ways, our friend in undoing in a significant way the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. And, Alan, I have to tell you that this is one of the most exciting things we talk about in this radio program. I have seen nothing but positive results as we have tried to cultivate family economies. And I hope I'm not exaggerating it here, but I think that this is what it will take to salvage our economic systems and our families and our social systems in the years to come. I think we have to do something radical like this in order to bring about a reconstruction of our socioeconomic system. You use the word unstable in your book for socialism and capitalism. In fact, you even say capitalism is unstable, and I never thought about that myself. Why are they so unstable?
Well, the great phrase from the economist Joseph Schumpeter comes into play here. His concept of capitalism as creative destruction. Okay. It can't leave anything alone. It is constantly striving, capitalism constantly striving to expand and to squeeze into every exchange that takes place all around the planet. It includes not only trying to displace what we'll call traditional economies in New Guinea, but it also means squeezing into your own home.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to replace homemade meals with factory-produced mail.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to, home-based meals with a trip down to McDonald's. It wants to replace your home garden with purchases that come through the system. It wants to replace homemade furniture with furniture you buy from the store. It always is pressing. Mm-hmm. Has to always expand market share. That's just the way it works.
It puts the almighty buck first, and it reduces family relationships. And I'm thinking, all the women in the workplace today, at one time, the heart of her husband safely trusted in his wife so that he should have no need to spoil. That was Proverbs 31. But hardly the case anymore. Now it's the heart of her corporate boss safely trusts in her, the heart of her bureaucratic department head safely trusts in her. And that family, relationship, that marriage relationship is really tenuous, more tenuous than ever before, if wives are out there in the marketplace working for somebody else.
Well, and this is where capitalism and socialism merge. On the one hand, capitalism wants the women in the marketplace. Why? It brings down wages. More people chasing the same number of jobs, lower wages. And that's what has happened in the last 50 or 60 years as a family wage system, which put limits on that, has just largely dissolved. At the same time, the socialist movement has succeeded in what I would call socializing women's labor. That's what researchers recently found. Some two sociologists looked at advanced welfare states around the world where feminist ideology, for example, had been most aggressively pursued. And they found, for example, it was in Sweden, where, again, feminism is almost the dominant political philosophy in that country. What has been its result? Well, women are now all in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
They've been made to be there.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost impossible not to do that. Well, what jobs do they have? Are they CEOs? Are they prominent lawyers? Actually, in Sweden, almost not at all. Almost all of them are still doing women's work. That is, they're teachers, they're caregivers, they work in the retirement homes, they work in the daycare centers. But instead of doing, they're still doing quote-unquote women's work.
Yeah.
Now they're doing it for the state.
Right, versus for the family, with their own children that they love. Yeah, okay.
And it's a huge irony, but it also gets at the fact that's actually been the socialist dream. It targeted the family as something that had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been this curious kind of a 1-2 punch. Capitalism undermines the family in its own ways just by the incentive it creates to centralize. And socialism wants to weaken the family because it's the main rival to the socialist ideal of pure equality of everyone dependent on the state equally.
Certainly Barack Obama understood that the largest socialist voting bloc in America was single women who are dependent upon the state for their bennies. And,
well, actually, no one should be surprised by that, but you're right. He understood that.
Mm-hmm.
And just by using some hiding that behind the he talks a lot about families, but what he's talking about are families where the breadwinner is the father rather than it's the state rather than the father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
So there's a lot of confusion in that.
Right. Now, you do talk about the new slavery in the servile state in your book, Third Ways. And you think we're moving back into slavery, I guess, don't you?
Well, that's the thesis of Hilaire Belloc, the English writer of about 100 years ago. He and G.K. Chesterton developed a method of analysis called distributism. But that was their conclusion, is that the world is moving towards basically a union of socialism and of capitalism, where most workers are happy to be without property in exchange for a wage that comes from the, I guess you'd say, from the capitalist side, and a set of benefits that comes from the government or socialist side. And they're willing to accept this new servility, this servile state, because it takes away a lot of their anxieties, and it's kind of a pleasant form of slavery. Mm-hmm. Now, what Belloc and Chesterton said, and what families are beginning to rediscover, is that the only source of independence and the true real security is to own property and productive property. And that means your home. That means the tools in which to do things and make things, ranging from hammers to computers, and land. Land, the autonomy that comes from having a home garden, maybe a chicken coop, and other ways in which you can recover the elements of a self-sufficient, autonomous economy, which I think the great philosophers from Aristotle to Thomas Jefferson, even to 20th century agrarian writers have seen that's the only real independence, the only alternative to the servile state.
Mm. Let's go back into history for a moment. I know that you are a student of history yourself, and you've looked at the development of economies in the Western world. Let's start back at the pagan world. They had slavery back then, chattel slavery, but gradually the world worked out of that as well. And we saw an increase of freedom occur in the Western world, didn't we, over time?
Well, again, Belloc's book, The Servile State, has a nice historical interpretation of this. He shows how the Christian message, which initially was the concept of equality, spiritual equality, all, we're all equal below at the foot of the cross, how that concept slowly, or actually, well, over the centuries, over the first 1,200 years of Christianity, eliminated slavery in Europe and basically drove it out. Replaced it with a system that reached its height in the high Middle Ages, which included a guild system which managed artisan work. It is true that you had a peasantry that owed their lord certain obligations, but over time those obligations, which actually tended to be mutual, were not so onerous, and you had a productive peasant class with at least certain claims to land rights.
Mm-hmm. And technically they rented the farmlands, as I recall, and they were able to keep a fair amount of the proceeds.
Well, it wasn't so much, it was rent. They paid a certain, gave a certain amount of labor to their lord, so to speak, for working on his land. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it was kind of like sharecropping, but over time, at its best, it tended towards increasing independence and autonomy for the peasants. Mm-hmm.
Were they family-based economies in the medieval ages?
Oh, without question.
Okay.
Without question. Okay. Again, there's a tiny percentage of people working for the state, maybe the army. There were some merchants who traveled around, but the overwhelming percentage, 90% plus, were people who lived and worked in the same place, which is how I define a family economy, most basically. They were either peasants running a farm, what we'd see today as something like a family farm, or they were artisans where they lived upstairs, their shop was downstairs, and the wife and the children were involved in the work of the shop.
Mm-hmm.
Or fishermen, too. Again, they weren't working for large, huge fishing conglomerates. They were little independent fellows. The fishwife and the children were involved in the business.
Massive revolutions of sorts came about then in the 17th century, 18th century, 19th century, where the old medieval world sort of turned into a world of capitalists and communists, I guess. Is that true?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, it depends on what country you look at the process. But in England, it was pretty clear that even as early as the 18th century, an emerging capitalist class, which merged with the old landed class, tended to monopolize property and took seized property through enclosures and other things from peasants. And also then the Industrial Revolution, which was launched in the late 18th century in England, which, if it had taken a different form, might have not been quite so onerous and quite so damaging, but wound up moving towards, again, a system of monopoly. The same people who controlled land wound up controlling most of the factories as well. And by the early 20th century, you had basically a land of where about 10% of the people controlled about 95% of all the assets. And again, that's and most people were did not own their homes. Most families were renters. The independent autonomy that was supposed to be there had been lost.
Now, in your book, you refer to some attempts to sort of retain something of a family economy in a couple different countries. You talk about the Bulgarian Greens, the Swedish housewives. There were these attempts. Why did they fail?
Well, again, it varies from story to story. One of the great potentials for restoration of a family-based economy came after World War One. Now, World War One was a horrible war. A lot of terrible things happened in Europe as a result, but some good things happened too. One was the breaking apart of the old empires, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, the German Empire, and the Turkish Empire all collapsed. And you had in Eastern Europe a whole group of new countries emerging, Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Finland. These are all did not existed as true nations before. They were all subject nations.
Okay.
And all had large peasant majorities. And democracy came in. The peasants were able to elect governments that favored small property and family-scaled enterprises. They mostly failed because they came to power with too little experience in governing, but also there were much more hostile ideologies out there, willing, all of whom had a common interest in crushing these peasant entities.
Yes, yes.
And it included communism, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, which was anti-peasant. It included fascism, which claimed to be pro-peasant, but never was. It included militarists and people like Benito Mussolini in Italy, who again said he was for the farmer, but was never really was. He really worked for the very rich in some respects. So the peasants were just too decent and too honorable.
Yeah.
In Sweden, you had actually women who were part of the socialist movement, but who said what socialism means is that, and what feminism means is that the state should be so ordered that mothers, wives and mothers can stay home with their children and be full-time homemakers. That's what they saw as freedom and economic justice. And they actually dominated the Swedish Socialist Party from 1900 until the 1960s when the feminist socialists took over and set out to destroy the homemaker.
Right. Now, I was a little surprised that you put the year of the disappearance of the family economies at 1970. Yeah, right there at 1970. I would have put it back in the 1940s, but
that was the family wage, which is something was just one aspect of a family economy.
Okay.
But you're right to go back to the 40s and 30s.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think would mark the end of it? Is that when dad goes to work, mom goes to work, the kids are all hustled off to their little slots and that sort of thing?
Well, dads went off to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But moms, again, the family wage came along, this idea that the factory system could have one but only one adult. It was going to be the father as breadwinner, and he deserved a wage that was sufficient to support him, his homemaking wife, and their children in decency and comfort. And we had a system in this country in different ways, it took different forms over between, say, 1860 and 1970 that delivered that by and large. That was there. Now, what was also happening is that in agriculture, the number of people living on farms in the United States reached a peak in 1917 at about 32
right.
million.
Right.
As late as 1940, it was still about 30 million, but mm-hmm. the farm sector was clearly in crisis at that point. And it was during and after World War II that there was a sharp acceleration in the introduction of heavy-scale machines, again, favored by government policy now. And also the policy directed towards farmers was get big or get out. And again, mm-hmm. the government manipulated various programs to ensure that end, which was to end family-scale farming and introduce agribusiness, mega farms, which operate just as factories do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was government policy starting really in World War II and in many respects continuing to the present.
And a lot of the farms were plagued by debt. A lot of the family farms are plagued by debt. And as you said, private property is the foundation of a free society. That's a major point, I know, in your book. Do you think that all the mortgages and the foreclosures are helpful to destroy the family economy and to erode private property ownership?
Oh, debt has always been the enemy of autonomy and independence. And
yeah.
if you can avoid debt or get out of it as quickly as you can, you're better off. What we're doing today is even worse than what was done in the 20th and 19th centuries. We're taking students and created this student loan system
yeah.
since the 1970s.
Yeah.
Instead of launching young people into the world, young people who've gone to college and university, instead of launching them in the world with assets, which is what families used to do, with gifts of property or gifts of a dowry or gifts of capital to get going, we're launching them off with debt, sometimes huge debts.
Incredible.
And we shouldn't be surprised that the statistics show that these young people are much less inclined to get married and have children. They can't afford it. It is the most stupid system I can think of for funding higher education, but it's the one we've come up with.
I think we're doing about everything we possibly can to destroy the future for our children, our grandchildren, their economies, their social systems. And Alan, I'm really out there on the front trying to rally the troops on this family economics idea. Anything else on how to empower family economies? Anything come to your mind here as we wrap things up?
Well, there again, it's overcoming the mindset that that you have to live and have to work in a separate place. It's understanding mm-hmm. that true human life, real human life, begins reintegrating home and home and work.
Mm-hmm.
There's countless ways to do that, and each family, each father, each mother, need to think of ways in which they can accomplish that. There's not one answer that's going to work for all, but there's thousands of possibilities, hundreds of thousands of possibilities,
mm.
and we actually have a great opportunity right now.
Yes.
For a real adventure in social and economic reconstruction.
Yeah.
It's happening.
I feel like I'm a part of it, and I'm really excited about it, to be honest with you, Alan.
You should be.
Yeah.
There's great opportunities out there.
Tremendous, right? Tremendous opportunity. We actually do talk about household economies that have a single stream and others that have multiple streams so that, you know, dads don't have to feel like they have to come home right away and just do the straight entrepreneurial thing on day one. We try to open up lots of options for families to explore these things. And we just think if we start planting these seeds, eventually 10, 15, 20 years from now, we may have something here.
I think so.
Okay.
Godspeed.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for the interview, Alan. And we want to encourage folks to grab your book, Third Ways. Available just about anywhere on the internet. Alan Carlson's book is Third Ways. Thanks, Alan. God bless you.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's not just us talking about these things. It's others as well. And Alan Carlson's from Hillsdale College, and he's got a great book out called Third Ways. Now, my friends, if you would like to be part of this grand movement as we take advantage of some opportunities where things are breaking down socially, economically, but we're coming back to some of the basic biblical principles. We believe ultimately these things are contained in the book of Proverbs and other places throughout Scripture. The wisdom of God is something we need to really rely on in times like these when everything is breaking down. Well, we're reconstructing these family economies through our family economics conferences, and you need to attend at least one of them, friends. And our next conference is at St. Louis, Missouri in May of this year. Coming up just a couple of 4 or 5 months from now, friends, we will be in St. Louis, and we're already breaking records for pre-registration. So if you'd like to be part of that conference, register right now at familyeconomics.com. Also, we're doing one other conference in Washington State in October. And that thing's filling up too, from what I understand. If you'd like to be a part of that, same website, familyeconomics.com. Exciting times. An exciting future, I think, awaits ourselves and our families and friends. Get involved in this movement now, the Family Economics Movement. And we have the website. It's familyeconomics.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.